Welcome to my podcast, existing and newcomers, existing listeners and newcomers. You probably also share why or who I am a little bit to explain to listeners why you may be interested in listening to me. So I currently work in tech and I am enrolled to go to law school this year, which is coming up pretty fast. In this podcast episode, I'm just going to review my week. There'll be some rambling thoughts, but I'm going to review my week. Just share my thoughts and reflections on it. So, what did I do this week? Was it Monday that the Warriors won the finals? No, it was Wednesday, right? So, Wednesday, the Warriors won the NBA finals. So, that happened. This past week also, I worked overtime, and I was thinking, wow, this is so exhausting. I think I worked like at least 12 hours a day. So for five straight days, that's like 60 hours. I don't know if you count lunchtime or something like that. But I was like, I've heard people say that they've worked 80 hours before. I think those are like hours that are common for investment bankers and lawyers. But I was like doing the math, like how many hours a day do you have to spend 80 hours a week? And that would be 16 hours every day. So if you sleep 8 hours for the whole day, pretty much you'd have to be working because there's 24 hours in a day, 8 hours if you sleep, that leaves 16 hours. 16 times 5 is 80. And that's a lot. Like, but just like, how is that even possible? You must either sacrifice sleep to work 16 hours a day, or you must sacrifice like eating, unless like maybe you count the hour that you're eating and working at the same time. So that all adds up to 80 hours. Or maybe it's like an 80-hour work week, including like weekends. So you like split it and you do some work during the weekend. That would kind of make sense, I guess, which would suck. But it was exhausting. But there's a the reason I was working overtime was because there was this very, very urgent deadline that I had to meet. And it would have impact, real world impact. And it wasn't just like, it wouldn't reflect poorly on my performance. So that's why I was really motivated to try to meet this deadline. But there's something, even though it's exhausting, there is something about that motivator. Like, what the reason behind why are you doing that work? And now there's not something about the work. The motivation behind the work infuses whatever you're doing with meaning. And whatever you might have been doing with that time, watching a show, maybe even cooking, for me, the work that I was doing was more meaningful than maybe some other daily activities I would have been doing. So that overtime work, because of also of the urgency, I was just so engrossed in my work. There was just such a meditative component to it, and also just a sense of purpose and sense of fulfillment as well. And that's for like an extended period of time, like 12 hours a day-ish. So as exhausting as it was, the overtime work, there was something intoxicating about it. Maybe that's what's dangerous about overtime work as well. Because you get so engrossed in that work, and especially if you find something that's like fulfilling and you enjoy it, you don't mind the overtime as much. So you accept it and then you embrace it. And then as you embrace it, your time, the proportion of your time that you spend on that work is larger and larger. And that work consumes your life. And then your life becomes about work. And I don't know. I mean, yes, it's better if you do work that you enjoy. But if you didn't enjoy the work, then you might resist that overtime work. And then you might try to find measures to not work overtime. But if you enjoy that work, you might embrace that overtime. And then that might add to the risk of you indefinitely adding, routinely working overtime and taxing your body and having work consume your life. Perhaps the phrase work consumes your life gets a negative connotation. Because what if work is fulfilling? Like, what if it... Whatever you're doing at work has a lot more impact than you like watching Netflix or even going to the gym. That's like helping yourself, really, which is, you know, your health is very important. But is it as meaningful as something that's going to impact the world, the outside world? Arguably, no. It's more impactful to do the work. So, yeah, work consuming your life has a negative, like, narrow, one-sided connotation. Because if your work is meaningful and you are engaged in it, then lots of your work should translate into real-world impact. And that, many can argue, is more meaningful than, I guess, your personal happiness. That does sound controversial. The happiness of others and the contributions to society versus your own personal happiness. Because if we have limited time, those interests can compete against each other. Doing work may not make you necessarily happy, but it will contribute to the outside world. But you being happy then means that you'll do activities that really benefit you more than others, generally. So, and because of time, you have to choose between the two. So, sometimes I guess personal happiness and meaningfulness, meaning in your life and in the work that you do can conflict. The ideal situation, I guess, and then this might explain the underlying attitude I had with doing overtime, is when you find joy in the work that you're doing. So if you, like, the time that you spend doing work, then aligned with both meaning in your life and happiness. Yeah, but that's also dangerous, I think. Unless you're comfortable having work consume your life, which isn't that bad, maybe, if you're both doing meaningful work and you're happy, right? But assuming it's not for some folks to do that, yeah, that's, I think, the dangers of, like, doing overtime work regularly. I only did it for a week, at least this week. But after I did it, and then I stopped thinking about whatever task I had to do because I completed it. I was, like, it's not foreignness, but I spent, like, so much time away from the general things I think about, from, like, other day-to-day things I think about, that when I thought about them, they came as a little bit of a surprise to me. So I feel like I neglected other parts of my identity after, like, coming back from overtime, I think. I remember really, like, I remember, like, looking at myself in the mirror, and then I haven't shaved in a while. I was like, whoa, I was surprised to see that, because that image was such a low priority in my conscious mind that I wasn't really thinking about that. So that's danger, I think. And it's just a function of time. If you spend the majority of time reading, let's say, you can call yourself a reader. Your time that you spend is a huge, if not the primary component of your identity, I feel like. Where you spend your time is a primary component of your identity. Like, if just the fact alone that if I had spent, like, 12 hours in a church, like a Christian church, every day, wouldn't that automatically kind of make me a churchgoer as an identity? Maybe not necessarily Christian, but the activities that I spend my time on define who I am. So your identity is a function of the time that you spend and the nature of things that you spend your time on. And therefore, working overtime then disproportionately defines your identity. But a person's identity is much more complex than work, I think, at least for me. So those are my rambling thoughts. Those are the reflections I had while doing overtime. Also, I mean, in summary, doing overtime work doesn't have to be competing with your happiness. If the work that you do is meaningful and you find joy in it, then why not, like, engross yourself in overtime work? And then the second part of that is, and then I guess the counterpoint is, to a human identity, I feel there's a lot more complex elements to it instead of just work. The more I say work and I talk about identity and identity kind of alienation, the more I think about Marxist ideologies. You know, wasn't that the idea that work can be alienating to the identity? In a sense, kind of with the way I'm arguing and just characterizing overtime, man, I feel like I'm making an argument for Marxist socialism because of that. At least that strain. I'm not going to say I'm Marxist because there's so much more to Marxism there, and I think some of his propositions are, for me, a little too extreme, like doing away with capitalism and if I understand Marxism correctly, like doing away with capitalism and then profits, it's everything state owned, the individuals, an individual enterprise doesn't exist, and the profits from an individual enterprise are then go to the state and are equally distributed to the people. That's kind of like the idea, right? I don't know. Maybe I'm probably ignorant on that, but yeah, I wouldn't go to that extreme. And I mean, I'm a big proponent of reaping the benefits, the incremental benefits from your incremental merits. But there is a threshold, I believe. And I guess that is that socialist kind of Marxist element. You work too much, and you just contribute to the capitalist engine. Which, I mean, saying a capitalist engine is also like a very narrow way of describing your work. Yes, the work that you do generates profits for a company, a private company. But there's so much, it's so much more than that. It's like, what if the product that you create like really changes the world and helps people, right? That's not a capitalist element. There's a, I wouldn't say altruistic, but there's an extrinsic, there's like an externality to it. So, capitalism is one dimension to characterize a phenomenon, one dimension of many. It is not the entirety of the phenomenon. Yeah, I was about to summarize over time, but then I like summarize the first point that a work can be compatible with both meaning and happiness. And then the second point, I went on a digression. But the second point being, there are a lot more complex elements to our human being's identity that consuming yourself in it, and maybe you neglect other parts of your identity and you just alienate the self from it, which is, I think, a very Marxist characterization and concept. Thoughts of overtime. I think it also just aligns with the general principle of like doing anything in excess is not good. Do everything in moderation. And overtime, by definition, is working excessively. All right, those are my thoughts on overtime. Obsessing. But I mean, overtime is another way of also like, when you obsess over something, you're going to spend a lot of hours in it, right? You're going to work overtime in something. So overtime may just be another way of saying you're obsessed about something too. We don't necessarily look down upon that. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a sign of you being thoroughly engaged, deeply engaged, and doing something that you're passionate about. That is, there's a difference, I guess, between willing overtime and unwilling overtime. Intrinsically driven overtime and then extrinsically driven overtime. I mean, for me, I had a deadline, but honestly, if I wanted to suck at it, I could have. But I didn't want to suck at it. And a lot of that was intrinsically driven. Overtime needs distinctions. It's like a monolithic phrase for something negative. Like, oh, you overburn yourself. You're going to burn out by working overtime. But overtime is also something that you might do in something you're passionate about. You just don't call it overtime. Yeah. I am advocating here for a more nuanced interpretation of overtime. And when we reference overtime to evoke those nuances, to say like intrinsically motivated overtime or extrinsically motivated overtime, perhaps I can think of a better phrase than that. It's like, that's a pretty long phrase. But yeah, there are nuances to overtime that we should not neglect. All right. Next up, the Golden State Warriors win on, was it Wednesday? Yes, I believe it was Wednesday, where Steph Curry has finally won the finals MVP trophy. This eluded him for like the past three championships that the Golden State Warriors won, but it's probably fair and very accurate to say that he might have been, he's the most important Warriors franchise player, at least in this dynasty, the past 10 years, and maybe arguably ever. The most important player for the Golden State Warriors ever in their franchise. But he finally won his finals MVP trophy. Yeah, I think he played pretty great. And I think you really saw his defense get really good. Oh, and for those who don't know, the NBA Finals trophy is awarded to the most valuable player in the NBA Finals. The NBA Finals is a series of games between two teams, one from the Western Conference, which roughly translates into Western side of the United States. Again, and then a team from the Western Conference, the best team from the Western Conference, and the best team from the Eastern Conference. And then they battle it out until the first team that reaches four gets there. Like, the team that wins four games first is the NBA champion. And this time it was Golden State Warriors. They won 4-2 games that the Celtics won. And the NBA Finals, MVP is awarded to the MVP of the NBA Finals, and that was awarded to Stephen Curry, though I think he should have probably won. And this is Steph Curry's fourth championship. But his first championship was, when was it? Not 2012, because that was like LeBron and LeBron versus like the San Antonio Spurs. It's like 2015, was it? When did Steph Curry win his first championship? His first championship. He won it off 2015. I got it right. Nice. Good on me for memory. But yeah, 2015 was his first championship, and then Andre Iguodala won that Finals MVP, particularly, I guess, for his defense on LeBron James. But arguably, Stephen Curry should have won. So to me, it's like him finally getting the recognition in a trophy form. That's very belated, that he deserved a while back. So congrats to him. From finally getting due belated credit. When somebody's merit, and I think many people in the corporate world can empathize with this, when someone's merit doesn't match the extrinsic accolades that are out there, there's just something very unsatisfying about it. And that was the case with Steph Curry. His impact on the NBA game, his impact with the Warriors, I think the predominant reason they won four championships, the primary reason that they won four championships, his merit was way above the extrinsic, not way above, but definitely above the extrinsic accolades he received. Yes, he won two league MVPs, one of the first ever unanimous league MVP, which that might have been a little excessive based on the merit, especially when you consider the other players that were in the league at the time he was awarded the league MVP, the regular season MVP. But take that out, really. I think, okay, yeah, you know what? It was just that Finals MVP. But still, there is a little bit of a discrepancy between his merit and the extrinsic accolades he received, and that was a little unsatisfying. So it was finally satisfying as a viewer to see that his extrinsic accolade matched his merit and his contributions to the Golden State Warriors. And honestly, quite frankly, the whole NBA. Yes. So congrats to the Golden State Warriors. I think a huge reason why they won in the finals, especially the last game that they secured to land them the championship, was this player called Andrew Wiggins. So the Boston Celtics has this player called Jason Tatum, who has been a superstar during the playoffs. With all the challenges that they faced and all the teams that they faced to get to the NBA finals, Jason Tatum was their best player from the Celtics. But Andrew Wiggins locked Jason Tatum up really well. Just made it very difficult. Jason Tatum fired one air ball that I saw. Got blocked several times from Andrew Wiggins. And his field goal percentage was terrible. I think at some point in the fourth quarter, the announcer said it was like 5 for 18, which is like less than 33%. So that's really low. So that guy really locked down the Boston Celtics' best player, who, by definition, almost of being the best player, was the best chance for the Celtics to beat the Warriors. And Andrew Wiggins shut that down. I mean, a very similar kind of impact, I guess, to what Iguodala did to LeBron James in 2015, except it was, you can't stop LeBron. Like, he still scored. But in this game for the Celtics, Wednesday's game, Jason Tatum could not score, and Andrew Wiggins was a big reason why. All right, that's enough about the NBA. I wonder whoever was listening to my talk about overtime, and then I talk about the NBA. Like, that same person who's intrigued about overtime may not likely be as interested about the NBA. But I am a man of eclectic interests. All right, so that's the Golden State Warriors. That happened this Wednesday. Another thing in the week for the week in review was just a stock market crash. Is the stock market leading of economic conditions? Like, it's a leading indicator? Because if so, then A recession is either here already or it's coming because, oh my goodness, oh, the stock market crashed so hard this week. It hurts me more because I feel like I have a finite time horizon with my investments because I'm going to use them to fund my law school. Or that was a plan, but if I use them sooner before the stock market recovers, I feel like I am losing out on some gains to recover some ground for my stock market, and it would be a poor financial decision to sell them sooner rather than later to fund my law school. There's probably some math I can do on that. Like me funding, using my investments to fund law school, is the return on investment on that, if I can quantify the return on investment of using my investments to fund law school, is that greater than the returns I would get by leaving my stocks and my investments in the market? Quite. My answer to that question, based on just how drastically and how dramatically this stock market has dipped, is that if I wait it out, actually, that's going to generate more returns than me using that to fund law school and then using whatever financial returns I get from this law school education to then compensate for my opportunity cost of not leaving my investments in the stock market. Yep, that's my answer. But yeah, I lost a lot of money. I won't say how much, but it hurt. And made me dread going to law school just because of the now more expensive, how much more expensive it is. Like, I feel like a lot of people, not a lot of people. Oh, like I see a lot of businesses, I think the reaction to inflation, and then to themselves sustaining and then being able to weather the inflation storm for themselves and like manage rising expenses is of course to increase the prices. But at some point the prices are going to decrease the number of consumers, and that decrease of consumers, even with the rising prices, probably generate less revenue overall. So I feel like it can be counterproductive to continue to like raise prices. Yet that is pretty much all that I'm seeing across every business, restaurants, hair salons. And I understand, you know, you got to sustain your business, but there must be a point somewhere where raising prices too much was going to decrease your customers, and the volume is going to be too much of a factor that will then negatively impact your revenue. Also, last time I talked about a program that I created from Python. It's about like, 60 lines that automatically, I tease this a little bit, but what it does, it will buy a cryptocurrency that you designate, as long as you know the ticker symbol for it, and it'll buy it at a low price. And by a low price, you set the own. I set some parameters for this and how I define low price. But then once that trigger of low price, as I defined it, is triggered, then I buy the cryptocurrency, and then I just put in a sell order to sell it at 1% above what I bought it for. And then I wait until that's sold, and then I go through that process again. And it just loops doing that again and again. So I did that program, and I just wanted to report on the progress for that. And so far, I've made, $15 from that realized gains, $15 realized gains. And I'm just using just a little bit of money because I'm just cautiously testing out the program. Automated trading can get really wrong real fast. Especially let's say you implemented the wrong logic in your program and you're running a loop for it, then that wrong decision is just going to get repeated again and again because you're running a loop for it. And then one mistake gets multiplied into thousands, and thousands can then translate into magnifying the losses because of the wrong decision that you coded in. So that's why an automated trading program, at least in my experience, can be dangerous. And that's why I start with using a little bit of capital. And with a little capital that I used, maybe just putting $300 in for Ethereum and then selling it right away, back and forth. Maybe I started with 100 and then I upped it to 300. And then when the stock market, especially cryptocurrency, Ethereum has dropped 66% in the past 3 months. 66%. Wow. That is a lot.
A 66% drop from where it was like 3 months ago is like you have to like yeah like a 66% drop. What would you have to like recover from the price that it is now, from the lowered price it is? You have to like increase 150% to then get back to its original value, right? So like percentage wise, to recover and offset the drop that the crypto currency experienced, you have to increase by a higher percentage rate than its drop. I think that's right. Let's say, yeah. What is so? Let's say something $15 instrument, financial instrument drops by 66%. That is $10, right? To increase back to 15, you have to increase by 150%. So if you drop by 2 over 3, then it has to increase by 3 over 2. So Ethereum has dropped 66% in the past 3 months. That means it has to like increase by 150% ish to get back to where it was. And I think it can. So investing, yeah, if I believe it's going to go up, I should probably put some money into Ethereum. But it, to me, it's just like it's indicative of like the potential gains now. The ceiling for potential gains has now, to me, for Ethereum, it looks more appetizing. But oh man, the law school education and the expenses that I'm facing and looking into the future just has me dread and very reluctant in taking any more risk. But anyway, this automated program, the training program that I'm doing, earned about $15. I mean, it's not bad. I just run it in the background, so $15 free. And I think I ran it. Right now it's on hold because that last sell order that I put in hasn't gone through, and my program is not going to run again until the most recent sell order that I put in goes through. And that's kind of my way of making sure that I don't ditch myself into a hole or into a like a losing position, and then magnify that losing position. So I have to first make sure that I clear the selling order, the initial selling order that I paid, and then I would trigger another buy order. And the buy order, my principle for the low price, like the trigger for the low price, is really if the average weekly price, if the current price is lower than the average weekly price, like 98% arbitrary percentage, but like 98% of the weekly average weekly price, and if the current price is lower, then that's considered a low price. And then in addition, if I see a huge like stock drop in Ethereum, this is just based on what I was seeing was Ethereum, but like if it suddenly dropped 5%, then I would see like the next day it would like go up 5%. So what I did was like, if during the day the current price is 5% below its peak price in Ethereum, then buy this Ethereum as well. So that was kind of my conditions. And with that, I was able to earn like $15 combined with putting a sell order, a limit sell order saying I will only, the Ethereum that I just bought, I will sell at 1% above the price that I bought, and then wait until it's sold, and then I'll go through the process again. So that was a program I ran, and yeah, again, I earned about $15 realized gains from that. But unrealized losses, that's another story, because the sell order that I put in, where I bought, I think Ethereum at like 1,700, at that price, I didn't buy one Ethereum, so I bought less than that fractional quantity because I'm still pretty cautious about this trading program. Plus Ethereum, as we've seen during this week as well, it's like volatile, and sometimes it can be volatile in the wrong direction. It was just skydove, and its value dropped very heavily. Like I think, like I said, I bought it at 1700. It's like now at like 900. So it's like almost a drop of 50%. It's crazy. But yeah, so I bought it at like 1700 fractional quantities, and now it's like 900. But I put in a sell order for like 1800 or something. So that limit sell order has not cleared because Ethereum did not reach that high price back again. That 1%, 1.01 times of the original price that I bought it at. But yeah,
That's the automated trading program. I do have to say, I think my other applications in my my computer kind of slow down when I run this program in the background. So ideally, it'd be great if I had another computer, but that's an expensive resource. But I could probably run it while I'm sleeping. Well, it might add to my anxiety. Because the automated program based on what I told you guys, you buy when there's a certain low price or when there's a sudden drop in price, and then you just bank on the fact that Ethereum is going to go back up because of its natural volatility, and then you sell it, and then you go through it again. So in the description I'm giving you, the assumption here is that Ethereum is volatile enough, and volatile such that it goes up, down, both directions drastically and frequently. If that assumption doesn't hold, as it didn't hold this week, then this trading program it's not going to reap you any benefits. Yeah. But before this week, and maybe part of the prior week, before this week, the Ethereum was going kind of back and forth quite a bit. With some drastic movement. But the thing I realized when I was doing this trading program, that's important. Like the bid and ask spread of Ethereum is important. What I mean by this is that I said I buy Ethereum and then I sell Ethereum, right? And that's kind of like how I would make money. That if the selling price is higher than my buying price. But with Ethereum, even though there's like a market price, which is probably some price point between the bid and ask prices, when I buy Ethereum, I buy it at the asking price, at the price that sellers are willing to sell. But the price that buyers are willing to buy is generally lower than the asking price. So if the asking price is $1,800 for Ethereum, for example, that's what sellers are willing to sell it for. But if buyers, though, want to buy it at $1,700, then you won't be able to sell Ethereum at $1,800. If the asking price is $1,800, that's what sellers are willing to sell it for, and then the bid price is $1,700. That's what buyers are willing to buy it for. Me as a seller, I will not be able to sell Ethereum at $1,800 because buyers are not willing to buy it at $1,800. Their maximum is $1,700. So that's what makes this program kind of tricky and requires some patience as well, and does require that like dramatic drops and increases, especially increases, because the price that you buy it at from a seller will be more elevated than the price that when you subsequently try to sell for it, it needs to compensate for that differential in the bid ask spread. Because at $1,800, I buy it, buyers only need to buy $1,700, and let's say the stock price goes up and the bid price, well, roughly, let's say bid and ask prices are going to translate roughly to the rises in of the market price, let's say it jumps like 1%, then a 1% increase in the Ethereum's price is not going to automatically trigger my sell order, even if my condition is try to sell it at 1% above the price that I bought it at, because the bid price hasn't sufficiently increased to meet my original purchase price. $1,700, what is a 1% increase? Like $17? Yeah, so now the bid price would be like, with a 1% increase, it'd be like $1,717. Sure, the asking price is now like $1,818, $1,818. But then that's my limit sell order, that I want to sell it at that price. The bid, even though it increased, again, the Ethereum instrument increased 1%, buyers are only willing to buy it at $1,717. So 1% increase in the, so the takeaway is, for my program, a 1% increase in the underlying cryptocurrency does not translate to a sell order. Yeah, a change in, how do I put this? 1%, X% change in the underlying price of the cryptocurrency is not, I need more than that to be able to realize gains on my sell order. Now, I don't know what that magic multiplier is, but the reason I need that is because of the bid ask spread. It looked like it's a little wide for Ethereum. But my bank is that the volatility is more than the bid and ask spread.
And therefore, I can capitalize on the volatility, especially the pattern of dramatic increases and dramatic drops, such that I can make money off of it. Those are the assumptions and the parameters of my trading program. You're going to have mixed success because that assumption does not hold. But I'll report more and summarize that a little bit. Hopefully that made sense a little bit. And then at some point, I think once I try it out a little bit more, I'll share this. I think I will. I'm leaning towards sharing my code so that other people can look at it and try to use it. It's like a very simple piece of code. It's using the Robinhood API. I'm not a coder by training. I did take some coding courses, so I was able to code this in. But I'll share it out. Because the point is not to show off my coding skills, but just to show a simple function that can help you generate money. Of course, there are risks. Like I said, the parameters need to hold, and that is not always the case in reality. And if the reality does not hold, and you don't know what you're doing and like how you're running this program, then you may lose money. So, I mean, that's also why I guess I'm not sharing. I don't want to be responsible for people like running this and like losing money. Anyway, thanks for listening. That was my week in review. Reflections on working overtime, reflections on the Golden State Warriors winning. Congrats to Steph Curry for winning the Finals MVP and to the entire team for winning. I'm also just happy that Draymond Green was able to win as well because the Boston Celtics were very, very rough on him. So just seeing that triumph of one man beating 20,000 fans, it's nice to see. And then, yeah, the stock market crashing and then my ventures with a simple automated trading program. All right, that was my week in review. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe. I also do have a WordPress blog that I'm going to start working on. It's wordpress.com/hd_tck. And that's it, folks. All right, till next time. Bye.